From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The AFL-CIO gives its earliest endorsement ever. It backs President Clinton. We'll talk with Teamsters President Ron Carey. He has yet to throw his union's weight behind the president. We'll hear about a citizen's effort in California to clean up campaigns. And we'll talk with the man who ran against Bob Dole in 1974 and almost won, until Dole waged the first anti-abortion smear campaign in Senate history. All that and more on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Organized labor gave its earliest endorsement to President Clinton yesterday and also launched a big money campaign against the GOP Congress. Downplaying feuds over free trade and other issues, Vice President Gore accepted the AFL-CIO's backing.
Congress and it's time to turn them out.
And that was Vice President Gore accepting that endorsement. Joining me in the studio now is Juan Gonzalez, Daily News columnist and co-host here on Democracy Now! And joining us in our Washington studios of WPFW is Teamsters President Ron Carey. Ron Carey, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
And good morning, Ron. This is Juan Gonzalez. In 1991, Ron Carey was elected in one of the largest union elections in American history as the president, the reform candidate president for the Teamsters Union. Ron, this decision by the AFL-CIO, why was it taken so early in the presidential campaign by the AFL leadership this time?
Well, I really can't speak for the AFL-CIO, but I can tell you that we looked at the process and said, how can we best move working people's issues in this election year? We think the answer is to keep the debate alive, to make the politicians earn our vote. I think labor historically has rewarded its enemies and punished its friends. And so we think that America's working people have been taking it on the chin, the corporate greed that's robbing working people of all the gains that they've made over the years. And we want to make sure the politicians understand what our position is.
And so what particularly is causing you to withhold your support of President Clinton at this time?
Well, first, we think it's important, and it's certainly something I strongly believe in. It's important to talk to the members, to talk to the families, to talk to the officers, and get a sense of where they're coming from, and then make some decisions based on that result. We haven't done that yet, and as soon as we do, we'll certainly be looking at that. But I think there's lots of questions our members have, and I haven't heard the answers yet from some of the politicians, and I know you haven't, Juan. And we just think it's a little too early to take ourselves out of the game by making such an endorsement.
Well, clearly one of the big issues that all of organized labor was concerned about and has been concerned about for the last couple of years is the NAFTA agreement. I know your union was one of the most vocal in opposing the agreement, and I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how it has already affected the Teamsters and then in general what you see as its effect in the overall labor movement.
Well, first we have to talk about working people in this country, because I think what unions are doing today and what I strongly believe in is that a union speaks for working people. Whether or not you're a union member or a non-union member, you have to look at what's out there, the kinds of jobs that are being exported out of this country and the unemployment that's being imported into this country. When we hear the politicians talk repeatedly about good jobs, jobs have gone up. What are they talking about? Throwaway jobs, part-time jobs, temporary jobs? I don't know how you can compete with workers making $2 and $3 and $4 a day with no environmental protections, with no health or pension protections. So it's a very difficult process. We think that during that NAFTA debate and during the period that it was put into place, there could have been protections made for Mexican workers, protections made for American workers, and we think they ought to go back to the drawing board and start all over again.
But specifically in terms of the Teamsters, how would it affect the trucking industry?
Well, first of all, on December 18th, there was to be an expansion of the trucking in the border states. Theoretically, that would mean that trucks coming out of Mexico could go anywhere within those border states. And some couple of years down the road, they're then permitted to go throughout the United States. Now, let's talk about some of those trucks. Let's talk about the regulations. First of all, truck drivers from Mexico are not required to be retrained or trained in hazardous material. In fact, many of them cannot even speak English. They have a regulation driver's license, American Standard Driver's License, a CDL kind of thing, which is a commercial driver's license. They're not required to have that. The trucks are three times as old as American trucks. On top of that, they don't have front wheel brakes. There's a whole host of safety problems that I think Americans ought to be looking at. So that's the first thing that you would have in the trucking industry, in the Teamsters. You would have an expansion of trucking in the border states. On December 18th, we were out there with all sorts of environmental groups, with Mexican truck drivers, with the Mexican unions, and we were able to get this administration to temporarily delay this implementation of having trucks go throughout the border states. Well, that's the first thing. When you measure what's happened in industries, because Teamsters are not just truck drivers, they're pilots, they're policemen, they're nurses, they're doctors, they're manufacturing. Many, many good jobs are being lost into Mexico. And it's not about providing better wages, because the fact of the matter is Mexican workers' wages have gone down by 50%. So it's really we're getting back to the corporate greed all over again. And that is not talking about the kinds of problems you have at the collective bargaining arena when you would have a company like, for example, Hasbro, who would turn around and say, sorry, if you folks don't meet our needs here and don't make these major concessions, we'll move to Mexico. So it is a very difficult problem, and we're working very closely with the Mexican unions and the Mexican truck drivers to bring about some kind of legislation that would bring them up over the years.
We're talking to Teamsters President Ron Carey. Juan Gonzalez is with us in the studio. I'm Amy Goodman. Ron Carey, do you think that these kind of problems, the problems that led to you being opposed to NAFTA, can be categorized or characterized, as Vice President Gore did, as our mosquitoes of misunderstanding?
Well, I think that's a wrong characterization. First of all, I don't think we're a mosquito. The bottom line is we represent working people both in the union and outside of the union in a strong way legislatively. I mean, working people who don't have a union don't have a voice up there on Capitol Hill. We're a part of that. This is a mosquito that will have the, if that's his definition, will have the teeth of a tiger. Because we are not going to let go. These are issues that are important to working people in this country. They're important to our children and our grandchildren. We cannot afford to have this kind of an agreement, which puts us at a very uncompetitive position. And just in turn, ongoing rewards for the corporate special interests. It's greed all over again. The separation is becoming more and more clear in terms of less of the middle class and more of the rich and poor.
Ron, I'd like to ask you about a particular campaign that you were involved in, the battle over Avis Rent-A-Car and the employees of Avis Rent-A-Car. I wrote about it a couple of months ago, the campaign that you had to basically begin a consumer boycott of Avis based on its mistreatment of the Teamsters within the company. What's happened with that campaign over the last couple of months?
Well, we're making lots of progress. We're working with a lot of folks. And as you know, one thing we're doing in the Teamsters, I mean, we're moving away from the weakness and the corruption of the past and the image. We're getting more involved, members first, community activities. That's the kind of thing that works today. For example, we touched a minute ago about NAFTA in a strange way. So does the Hertz situation and all of the other fights that working people are facing today. In Watsonville, California, there was a company called Green Giant. Green Giant decided to move its operations into Mexico. And I think what you have to think about there is there not a responsibility, a social responsibility that that company had to the community, to the neighborhood grocer, to the public service people? Isn't there a responsibility that they have? That's the same kind of thing that's happening all over America. Corporations are just walking away from their responsibility. That's why we think it's important, this community involvement, getting out there, getting involved with church groups, with environmental groups, getting the membership involved out there, taking on the big fights head on, getting into the faces of politicians and letting them know how you feel. That's the grassroots campaign that we are doing in the Teamsters, not only just in these kinds of fights, but in organizing as well. And it's working.
I'd like to ask you also about the campaign that you have with the Disney Company. I mean, Walt Disney Company obviously now is part of the largest media company in America. What is happening in Disney Company with the Teamsters, and especially in Disney World? And what kind of campaign are you involved in there?
Well, we had our problems with them, and as a result of one of those kinds of campaigns I just spoke about, one where we were out there, we were leafleting folks who were coming into Disneyland, talked about the problems they had. For example, I don't think anyone understands the very difficult job Mickey Mouse has. Mickey Mouse is a Teamster, Donald Duck is a Teamster, and can you imagine the weight of those heads that sit on them and the health problems involved and figure the heat? And so a lot of that was ignored, but there was a lot of loyalty from the workers. They were concerned about the families that were coming down there. They wanted to take some tough positions, but certainly didn't want to disappoint anyone. Well, we had to use a different strategy, and again, getting back to the community involvement, membership involvement, other groups, we were successful in winning a number of steps that would alleviate some of those major problems. And we had that situation in one of the major hotels down there, the Dolphin, and as a result of that, they hired Hispanic workers, Haitian workers, and it's really ironic, Juan. When they want them not to understand something, they put it in English. When they want them to understand a rule or something that they're trying, they put it in their particular language. And it was an issue that we took on and finally won. We got an agreement down there. It's a good one, not only with some of the hotels, but certainly with Disneyland. And things are working out well. The membership, as you know, it's a right-to-work state, so members have a right not to join. But I must tell you that we've gone up terrific in terms of numbers in a right-to-work state.
I'd also like to ask you about probably the biggest challenge you're facing this year. It is the Teamster election that will occur later next year. Jimmy Hoffa Jr. is running against you. And what are the key issues that you're going to be focusing on to the membership? I understand that you did a poll in November that showed that you had a 3-to-1 margin of support among the membership. But what do you see as the critical issues that separate you and Jimmy Hoffa Jr.?
Well, I think when you say I'm running against someone, the individual I'm running against, it seems to me, is the weakness and corruption of the past. That's exactly what my running mate is. I mean, the choice for our members is a pretty simple one. It's the kind of union that they want. Do they want a union that fights the tough fights, a union that pushes forward, or do we go back to the weakness and corruption of the past? I don't believe the members want that. I think when you look at some of the things that we've been able to do, Juan and Amy, for example, the first thing I did was eliminate the jet planes, the limos, all of the perks, move and eliminate an outrageous multiple salaries. And for the first time since 1983, we've balanced the books. That's a pretty difficult task. I mean, it's only the tip of the iceberg. We're spending the members' money when we eliminated some of these outrageous kinds of spending. We put those monies to work for members and organizers, education, strategic approaches to negotiation, a legislative program that makes the Teamsters a real powerful voice for working people on Capitol Hill. And we put over 60 locals into trusteeship because wrongdoing of offices, corruption, we're not sending a message out there. Anything other than corruption has no place in the Teamster Union.
But Hoffa, on the other hand, claims that you're spending the union into bankruptcy, that the financial state of the union has never been in worse shape. How do you answer those charges?
Well, I think, first of all, he's not familiar with the facts. If he looked at the facts, he would discover that I inherited a bankruptcy when I came into the union, a union that had been overspending in terms of dues money since 1983. I came into office on February 2nd, 1992. The strike fund, they had borrowed money from the strike fund. These are all of the folks that the Hoffa legacy left behind. And, I mean, when Junior talks about bankruptcy, you ought to look at the facts. The budget is balanced. We do have a strike fund in place. I don't know how he argues with those kinds of facts. I think here's a guy who said, look, my dad was the Teamster president, so I ought to be. You know, the nepotism of the past. I mean, look at the folks that are running on his slate. It's all that approach. My dad was this, and so therefore I should run the union. Here's a guy, Junior, was never elected to any job in the Teamsters, never even a shop steward, never ran a union, never presented a grievance. So you have to look at what he brings other than the weakness and the corruption of the past. And that's not what the membership wants.
Ron Carey, I assume one of the issues they will raise, although you're talking about, you know, selling off the corporate jets, et cetera, is the $1 million pension fund that was just voted for you when you leave. What's your response to that?
Oh, I eliminated any special pension fund, I think, probably 6 months after I was in. Actually, what happened was the ivory tower, the group of the executives that sat around and made all these plans and never consulted with the membership, had a special pension program that existed for the general president and the general secretary treasurer. We immediately eliminated that plan. And we've gone even further than that to eliminate another plan. We froze the plan in its tracks because this union cannot afford it. And many union offices around the country already have a plan. So, and top of that, in trying to send out the right signals, the first thing I did was to reduce my salary by $50,000 the first year and another $25,000 the next year.
What kind of pension do you get when you leave?
Well, I get a pension from United Parcel Service, which is frozen because I worked as a package driver for over 12 years. As a result of monies that were paid into the Joint Council in New York City, I would get a very, very small pension there and a pension from the affiliates plan. And that's probably no more or no less than any other officers. I know my opponents are throwing all sorts of statements out there, but again, they're not familiar with the facts and would rather distort it.
Let me ask about another issue that has been crucial for the Teamsters in this past year, the Detroit newspaper strike. Because a Detroit strike has occurred actually in what you might call Jimmy Hoffa Jr. territory, there have been some who have said that the national conflicts between yourself and Hoffa have maybe made it not possible for the union to devote the kind of resources that it should to that strike. How do you assess the strike and the problems of conflict of leadership resulting from that?
Ron Carey, I'm going to have you think about that question for a minute because we do have to break. And we want to let people know we are speaking to Teamsters President Ron Carey. After that, we'll be talking about a cleanup campaign effort out in California. Today is primary day. And we'll also then be going on to an old-time opponent of Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole. His name is Dr. Bill Roy. He'll be talking about the campaign Dole waged against him in 1974. And we'll be joined by the president of NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Joining me in the studios, Pacifica Studios here at WBAI in New York, is Juan Gonzalez, columnist with the Daily News and co-host on Democracy Now! Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Is Pacifica's daily grassroots national election show. Our guest at this half hour is Teamsters President Ron Carey. What about the Detroit newspaper strike that Juan just asked you about?
Well, let's talk about what we have done so far. First of all, we are dealing with a very difficult situation. There are a number of unions involved. I have been involved in every step of this. For example, involved with the Strategic Approach Committee with the AFL-CIO, where a number of different strategies have been put into place. For example, a field strategy, a public relations strategy. Right now, going on in Detroit, it's my understanding that we have got more and more of the community involved in this, church groups, women's groups, environmental groups, and that's really the key, aside from throwing lots of dollars. Now, I personally have gone up and have picketed at the Gannett building in Roslyn in Virginia. And we've had our pickets out there. We're providing an adopt-the-family approach. This will be a long strike. There is no doubt about it. The issues that we're confronted with are very difficult issues. But this is one that the labor movement has to win. And something I've said repeatedly, we have to throw everything at this. And that means from the entire American labor movement, and I think that's being done. I've been up there a number of times. I've met with our, if you will, field commanders, because that's what it's about. This is a war. When we talk about leadership, there have been some folks up there, Junior being one. He's had a golden opportunity to show us what leadership should be about. Well, he hasn't been anywhere around, and that's probably what we figured in the first place.
In terms of leadership, the new AFL leadership, you were a backer of John Sweeney and Trump Gunn, the new slate that has now taken over the AFL. How do you assess the first few months of this new leadership? Is this really a new face for labor that is going to begin a new offensive in terms of defense of worker rights, or is it something else?
Juan, I was very disillusioned with the AFL-CIO when I first sat on there as one of the executive committee. It adopted resolutions. It talked about things, but I looked behind them. I saw no activity, and so to make speeches and to do all of these things and have nothing to follow it up, it was very, very disappointing for me and very difficult. And that's why I got behind a group of people, and it's not about personalities. It's about a direction. It's about what is needed in this country, a strong, very progressive labor movement. And from the first day that they assumed their positions, and I'm talking about John Sweeney, Rich Trumka, and Linda Chavez Thompson, you could see the enthusiasm in the room. You could sense it. You could see the direction. They started talking about things, about moving things and directing in directions that would fight for working people, about not supporting candidates who weren't supporting the kinds of candidates that voted in behalf of working people, the programs they're putting together. For example, Reclaim America. That's what workers in this country ought to be talking about. We're falling far behind corporate CEOs' compensation, 150% of what a worker makes in terms of an hourly rate. Someone has got to get out there and start talking about working people, and I think you're beginning to see that. It won't be an easy task. It won't happen overnight. But the Reclaim America, the efforts and the energies and putting these committees together and the kinds of resolutions that are being adopted and the action that goes behind them, I'm very excited about, and I consider myself pretty much a guy who wants to see things move forward.
One last question. In terms of the the 60 locals that you say you've put into receivership, a lot of that has been on the recommendation of the independent review panel of the federal government, and there are those who criticize the tremendous amount of involvement of the federal government in Teamster affairs. If you're elected president, do you see a period when you will seek to end this federal intervention into the union's affairs?
Absolutely. But that won't ever happen until we're able to do the job that we should do. For 88 years, the leadership in this union has swept corruption, wrongdoing, nepotism under the carpet. Never had the guts to take it on. And Juan, I'll take exception to one thing you said. The government has made recommendations. The government would give us information and make a recommendation, not in all 60 of the locals. We have, through our Ethical Practices Committee, and that's the way we remedy the problems in this union. This union belongs to the members. It does not belong to the officials. And that's what we've had, the things that they've done, the wrongdoing, the hand in the cookie jar. I was elected by this membership to clean this union up, to move it forward in terms of its grievance procedures and pensions, and I've done that in terms of negotiating some of the highest money in the freight agreement, in the UPS agreement, in the history of this union. And so we're not going to accept anybody dragging this union back. Yes, I'd be delighted to see the day that the government leaves this union. But we have to have a process in place that makes sure it's forever cleansing itself and never go back to the weakness and corruption of the past.
Are you concerned at all about the makeup of this independent review board? I mean, the former head of the CIA and FBI, William Webster, the very conservative judge, Lacey.
Well, I don't have a say-so in that. Obviously, we have one choice or one recommendation. And we have that recommendation on the board. I don't, have a choice in terms of Judge Webster and I believe Judge Lacey.
Well, let me ask you one other.
I think the way we get past that, Amy, is to make sure that we've got a process that does the cleansing, that rips out corruption wherever it raises its ugly head. And that's what we've been doing. And that's why there's a lot of folks out there that are not happy with Ron Kerry. I mean, Ron Kerry has come into the picture. He's eliminated outrageous pay. He's cut his own salary. He's eliminated two pension programs. He's gone after corruption. And that's not the kind of union that a lot of officials or many officials who have been removed think a union ought to be. It's for them, they believe, and this is for the members.
Speaking of cleanup, Ron Kerry, some were surprised to see you outside the Javits Center, the big convention center in New York, with Mayor Giuliani, who then went on to say he was cleaning up the Fulton Market, a place of a lot of Teamster activity, saying it was mob-infiltrated, and replaced people there with a contractor that was fiercely anti-union, had a lot of complaints against it with the NLRB. How did you feel? Did that make you reassess your stance standing with Mayor Giuliani, who many see as quite an anti-union mayor?
Well, first I'd like to say, Amy, I was not outside with Mayor Giuliani. He may have been somewhere else, but he certainly wasn't at our press conference. And I was there because what we had going on there is the standard thing that goes on quite often, and that is the nepotism, the mob control, where the union officers just say, hey, the members don't count. They don't have any say-so around here. We call the shots. And I went in there, and I had that press conference, and it was about straightening out that local. And I think it's back on track. I had no connection with Mayor Giuliani or with Governor Pataki. I know shortly thereafter that they made some public statements. And by the way, we don't have anything to do with the Fulton Fish Market. So I don't know what connection that has to do with it.
More just that Mayor Giuliani, when he went in there, not to do with the Teamsters, but he brought in this anti-union contractor and is seen by many as a very anti-union mayor.
In the Fulton Fish Market?
Yes.
I don't know that. If there were labor people involved in that, I would have been out there fighting for their rights as well, because I think what affects one affects all.
Well, Ron, I'd like to thank you for being with us this morning, and I want to wish you a happy birthday. I understand you reached your 60th birthday this week, and I hope that you'll be able to return sometime later on in the year as we get closer to the presidential race to talk with us about labor issues. So thanks very
much
for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
President Ron Carey, president of the Teamsters. Yesterday, the AFL-CIO gave its earliest endorsement ever of the Clinton-Gore ticket. And Teamsters president Ron Carey says he's going back to his union to talk with his 1.4 million members about where the Teamster stands. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We're going to move now into another segment, and then we'll be joined by a man who ran against Senator Bob Dole in 1974, and will be also joined by the president of the National Abortion Rights Action League. Today is primary day in California, Washington, and Nevada. In the next few days, we'll talk about cleaning up nuclear waste in all three states, at Yucca Mountain, at Ward Valley, and Hanford in Washington. But today, we go out to California on another cleanup issue. Larry Bensky joins us from Berkeley.
Today we are voting, as you say, in California, and it's unusual in one sense in that the legislative candidates for the California Assembly and the Senate have had a chance to kind of clean up their act for the first time, thanks to an organization called the California Voter Foundation, which has asked all the legislative candidates, everybody running for the Assembly and the State Senate, to take a pledge saying that they will abide by five measures, two of which are especially interesting. They will decline gifts that appear to be linked to legislation, and they will vote their conscience and put the interests of their districts before those of contributors. Kim Alexander is executive director of the California Voter Foundation. Kim Alexander, you've had some success with legislative candidates so far getting them to take this pledge.
We have, Larry. We've had about 145 candidates and incumbents sign the pledge so far. That's about a third of the field of legislative candidates this year.
And what do the ones tell you who say they won't sign? In what sense do they decline to pledge to not link campaign donations to legislation, to vote their conscience, to refuse to participate in action that would pose a conflict of interest? What do they say when they turn you down?
Well, a few members, incumbents only really, have said that they feel like the pledge is the same as the oath of office that they've already taken, which actually isn't true. There are a number of provisions in the pledge that go above and beyond the oath of office for a California lawmaker, but that's typically the response that we've gotten from a few of the legislators who have chosen not to sign the pledge.
Kim Alexander, these, of course, are just their pledges. They're not legally binding.
That's correct, Amy. They're not legally binding, and this is really just a way for voters to express basically a wish list of how they would like to see the lawmakers behave in Sacramento. The people who wrote the pledge spent 5 months drafting it. It was a multi-partisan group of citizens involved in a civic journalism project that we co-sponsored with the San Jose Mercury News. And these people worked very hard to come up with a pledge that would be nonpartisan, that would be something that people could sign, that wouldn't be asking them, you know, for anything that would be unreasonable. And I really admire the people who worked on this. It was really a labor of love, and they've put it out to everybody to sign. And it's really up to the candidates and the lawmakers to decide whether or not it's something they want to abide by or not. But it's people can violate it, and there's no, you know, there's not going to be any inquisition or something for people who don't abide by it. But they'll just have to deal with their conscience.
There are a couple of measures here which are going to be difficult for some candidates to abide by, Kim Alexander. One is by avoiding personal attacks while campaigning. They pledge to avoid personal attacks while campaigning. The other is that they will treat colleagues and constituents with dignity and respect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've seen numerous elections for local offices here in California as well as nationwide where people don't abide by these provisions. What are you going to do when they don't? Are you going to call a press conference, put out a press release, picket their offices? Don't you have to be kind of proactive to make sure that they stick to this pledge?
There needs to be a proactive element to it. And in fact, we've been getting some calls from some campaigns already saying that their opponents have violated the pledge. We've urged them to write up a press release, send it to us, send it to the San Jose Mercury News. And I believe the paper is going to be coming out with an article for about that very situation over the weekend. So we are doing what we can to monitor it. And, you know, people will violate it. I mean, things like this have been done before, and they've been violated, and it's disappointing. But I think that we have to start somewhere. I think that citizens need to articulate what it is they want to see from the legislature, how they want to see them behave. And we need, and fortunately, because of the World Wide Web, we can set up a place where a public record is created where everybody can go and look and see who's agreed to abide by this pledge and who hasn't.
What's that World Wide Web address?
Well, people can get to the Statement of Accountability page through the California Voter Foundation's homepage, and that address is www.webcom.com/CVF/, as in California Voter Foundation.
Kim Alexander, how did you manage to pull this off? How did this bipartisan effort come about?
Well, it's the Civic Journalism Project that I've been the project director for the past year sort of evolved originally out of a series that the Mercury News ran in January of 1995, which covered the influence of money in Sacramento. It documented how special interests were getting their agenda pushed in Sacramento and getting legislation passed that benefited them. And as part of the series, they included a box, an invitation to readers to contact the paper if they wanted to get more involved in addressing this problem. The paper felt that they needed to do more than just tell people how terrible everything was, that they wanted to go beyond just throwing news at their audience. They wanted to help people look for solutions in a nonpartisan way, and that's exactly what we've done. This project came out of this series and was funded by the Pew Center for Civic Journalism. It's one of numerous civic journalism projects across the country that is seeking ways for the news media to reconnect with their audience and help their audience deal with public problems in a constructive way.
When you base your project, however, on something like individual newspaper or individual newspaper and television station journalism, don't you run up against the jealousy barrier that we always see in American journalism, where if it's the San Jose Mercury News' project, the Chronicle's not going to write about it in San Francisco, the Times isn't going to pick it up in L.A., et cetera. How have you confronted this barrier with your particular initiative?
That's a very good question, Larry, and we actually have been able to, with the Statement of Accountability, overcome that barrier. I mean, the Statement of Accountability and the drive to get pledges was something that was of interest to newspapers across the state, and we've had articles written about the Statement of Accountability in the Orange County Register and the Fresno Bee and the Sacramento News and Review and other papers in California that recognize that this is something that's of interest to their readers, despite the fact that it came originally out of another news organization. And I think that's a real triumph for the project, that we were able to overcome the very problem that you described.
How do you fit into these kind of efforts around the country? Are there other similar ones in other states and other parts of California?
You know, this is something that I think has been tried before and will continue to be tried again. I'm sure that there are other efforts in the country underway to get accountability through a pledge drive. And I hope that there's other ones. I mean, this is something that's really critical, that citizens need to take the initiative. They need to learn to articulate what it is that they want to see from their legislatures and hold them accountable for their promises. And we just don't have that right now. There's not enough proactive events on the part of citizens right now in this country. We need to see more of it. Anybody is welcome to go onto our webpage and borrow the Statement of Accountability and use it in their own, adapt it and use it in their own elections if they'd like. But, you know, I think that we're right now just trying to set a good example for other people to see how the internet particularly and citizens in general can use good old-fashioned shoe leather and hard work to get what we want out of Sacramento and out of our state politics.
And that is Kim Alexander with the California Voter Foundation. Thank you very much for joining us, as well as Larry Bensky out at our Pacifica station, KPFA. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacific Radio's daily grassroots election show. Coming up next, a man who ran against Bob Dole more than 20 years ago. He's got quite a story to tell. We'll also be joined by the president of the National Abortion Rights Action League after this. Thank you. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, reporting to you from WBAI studios here in New York. Joining us now are two people. We're going to be talking about Bob Dole's record on abortion. He proudly stands in rallies around the country, Christian Coalition rallies, holding up his 100% rating from the Christian Coalition. And of course, abortion is a major part of that rating. Well, back in 1974, a House member who was an OBGYN ran against Bob Dole for the Senate. Dole waged an ugly anti-abortion smear campaign against his opponent, calling him an abortionist, and going so far as to have supporters take out ads in newspapers with skull and crossbones. It was the first time abortion was so politicized in a congressional campaign. It was the year after the Roe versus Wade decision legalizing abortion. Joining us to talk about this issue is the man who ran against Bob Dole. His name is Dr. William Roy. And we're also joined by the president of the National Abortion Rights Action League. We're joined by Kate Michaelman. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Lisa.
Why don't we start first with Dr. Roy? Dr. Roy, what was that campaign like in 1974? It was right after Nixon had resigned, a close friend of Bob Dole, and it was right after Roe versus Wade.
It was a very good campaign from our perspective until the votes came in the last on that Tuesday, and it was a good campaign until the last weekend. Abortion did come up in a September meeting, a debate between me and Senator Dole, and it was a debate in which he had demanded that we debate agricultural issues and agricultural issues only at the Kansas State Fair. And it was televised statewide and was on the radio statewide. And as the debate was about to end, he turned to me and said rather gruffly, "Roy, what's your stand on abortion?" I had very little chance to answer. We did have an opportunity to sum up the debate to give our final statement, and Bob Dole at that time accused me of being for abortion on demand. And following that, I began to be heckled at different campaign stops by people calling me a baby killer and so forth. So it did go through most of the October, but it became very, very hot and heavy and undoubtedly won the campaign for Dole. I don't think there's one observer in 10 who would tell you otherwise. By the last weekend, on the last weekend, they put ads in the newspapers saying, "Vote for life. Bob Dole will support a human life amendment. Vote for Dole," with the skull and crossbones you mentioned, euthanasia on one femur, abortion on the other femur. And then on Sunday before election, they leafleted, put in windshield wipers in church parking lots, particularly Catholic churches, but some conservative Protestant churches, a leaflet that had pictures of babies in garbage cans and said Bill Roy's an abortionist and Bob Dole's for life. And the result of that was devastating in some precincts, in precincts that I had previously carried 60 to 40. I broke even. In precincts that I had broke even, I lost. And these were selective precincts. And we're talking about losing one or two votes a precinct to make the difference in that election because the margin was 49.2% to 50.8%. So in one sense, it was extremely unpleasant. Losing is unpleasant, and losing in that manner is particularly disappointing. And it was rather ironic that the weekend following the election, or the week following the election, I was asked by two Catholic hospitals to become part of their obstetric and gynecology department, and I ended up at a Catholic hospital here in Topeka as director of medical education following the campaign. So I was a physician of excellent reputation, and that was selectively used against me by Senator Dole. It was used selectively, and it was used late, and his very political viability, the fact he is still a politician and a senator and a Republican candidate for president, was the result of his campaign against me on the issue of abortion, which, as you indicated, he's boasted about at selected campaign stops.
You know, it's interesting. We had interviewed Stanley Hilton, who's the author of Senator for Sale. It's the story of Bob Dole. He had been an aide to Bob Dole. And he says that at a news conference covered by the Associated Press the day before your election, or the election in November 1974, Dole didn't specifically disavow any of the ads that were taken out by these Kansas anti-abortion groups, like Vote for Life, Bob Dole will support a human life amendment, Vote for Dole.
He reported those as contributions in kind following the election. Of course, his final report on contributions was not due until after the election. So he had ownership of those ads. And anybody who knows Bob Dole, particularly here in Kansas, knows that his campaigns are run by Bob Dole. He's a hands-on operator.
And you're listening to Dr. William Roy. He ran against Bob Dole in 1974. Now, you had some dirt on Bob Dole. At least you certainly knew about his relationship with Nixon. Nixon had just been forced to leave office. Why did you choose not to go that route? And what did you know about him?
Well, the conventional wisdom at that time was particularly that the last week or 10 days of the campaign, you run very, very positive. And retrospectively, we erred by running positive instead of running negative. We also overestimated the knowledge of the Kansas people as to Bob Dole's campaign tactics, which have been pretty consistent through the years, including this year, in a sense. The things which he did against me were very similar to what he did against Forbes, Buchanan, and others. But it's the opposition to Roe versus Wade that has resulted in the continuity of Senator Dole's campaign. And we can see now that he can't resist the opportunity to use his desire to deny women reproductive rights when he speaks to such groups as the Christian Coalition in South Carolina before that critical primary.
Let's bring Kate Michaelman into this discussion, Executive Director of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League. This is, what, 21, 22 years ago, this campaign in 1974, yet you held a news conference yesterday in Washington with Dr. Roy. Why?
Amy, first of all, let me apologize for calling you Lisa. I'm the one who did that. I'm sorry. The reason we held this press conference was very simple. Our polling shows that nearly half of voters in this country do not know Bob Dole's long, long, steady record of work to take away a woman's freedom to choose, either through voting for constitutional amendments that would criminalize all abortions, or whether it was voting against final passage of the federal clinic protection law, against domestic and international family planning programs. Bob Dole has cast, in his 28 years in the Congress, of 113 votes on the freedom to choose and women's reproductive rights and health, out of 113, he cast 107 votes against women's reproductive health and rights. Most people do not know that. They need to understand that a Bob Dole, as president, would not be an idle president as it relates to reproductive rights. In fact, he has said himself that he is a doer and not a talker, and we absolutely agree. He may not, as he goes into the general election, he may not talk a lot about a woman's freedom to choose, but as a president, here's what President Dole would do. He has promised to take action against the freedom to choose on his very first day in office by issuing executive orders to restrict abortion. He's promised to ban RU-46, which is the non-surgical abortion method. He's promised to prohibit federally funded fetal tissue research that is important in terms of promise for treating many diseases. He has promised to ban federal family planning programs and international family planning programs. He's pledged to prohibit U.S. service women serving overseas and military dependents overseas from being able to have an abortion in military hospitals if they need them, even if they pay with their own money. I mean, this is a man who throughout his years in Congress, and as you've heard from Dr. Roy, throughout his career as a politician, has used his opposition to Roe versus Wade and to a woman's right to make her own reproductive choices as a political tool to gain power and as a legislative tool in Congress. He is a candidate, the Christian Coalition, and other groups like Operation Rescue are desperate to have in office because they know he will continue their campaign against this constitutional right.
Kate Michaelman, what about the whole discussion of the possibility of a vice presidential running mate like Colin Powell that Bob Dole does not seem to be saying no to, which means he is leaving open the possibility of a pro-choice vice presidential running mate?
Well, I am sure that there are many in the Republican Party that would like to see him choose a pro-choice running mate because they know that in 1992, 17% by some political analyst's estimation, 17% of pro-choice Republicans defected from the Bush, supporting the Bush quail ticket because of their opposition to Roe versus Wade and their attack on the right to choose. And so pro-choice Republicans or some Republicans are very worried about this issue or Bob Dole's stand against the right to choose resulting in the same kind of defection from the party. I think I don't know what Bob Dole's going to do. What I would say to voters is that a vice president does not sign law. A vice president is not able to stop a Congress from assaulting the right to choose, as this Congress, the most anti-choice Congress in history, has done for the last year. The vice president, to me, it's not that they're unimportant, but they're not the person that will protect against assaults on our constitutional right and our access to health care. They are not the president who's going to veto bills that come that deny women the right to choose and make abortion more difficult and dangerous. So I also don't – I mean, common wisdom here is that Colin Powell is not going to run. I don't know what other candidates Bob Dole is considering. But given that he has kowtowed to the Christian Coalition and the right wing in his party, I'm not so sure that he will go so far as to choose a pro-choice vice president.
Do you then
add that the vice president does not appoint Supreme Court justices?
Oh, good point, Dr. Roy. That's another important point, that the Supreme Court could have as many as three nominees in the next term. And federal judgeships, as well as the Supreme Court, are critically important to the protection of the constitutional right. So the vice president doesn't do that. So the presidency is very important. But I will tell you that, you know, our polling also shows that overwhelming numbers of Republicans and independents disagree with and oppose the Republican Party platform plank calling for outlawing Roe versus Wade, or outlawing abortion, I should say, and overturning Roe versus Wade and appointing anti-choice justices to the court. There's real strong opposition, and our hope is that in this election year and over time, that moderate pro-choice Republicans will take back control of the party from the right wing.
Speaking of nominations, let me ask Dr. Roy, when you watched what happened to Dr. Henry Foster, who, of course, President Clinton nominated to be Surgeon General, what were your feelings about what happened to him vis-a-vis what happened to you?
Sort of deja vu all over again, I suppose. Here is a very highly respected man within the profession. I've known of him for very many years, and he is just torn apart by Senator Dole and a few others because he's done some medically indicated abortions. And it makes one sad that that can happen in this country. And this country is going to be very, very sad if the principles of Roe versus Wade are reversed. I know because I practiced before Roe versus Wade, and I practiced obstetrics and gynecology following my defeat in 1974, beginning again in 79. And it's very difficult when women have to go to back alley abortionists. I've seen at least one death and many infertility problems as a result of that, and when women are forced to carry pregnancies. So this is an extremely grave circumstance, and it really is one of the most important issues in our society. And the only thing I want is I want Bob Dole in South Carolina to be the same Bob Dole in California. And I know he will make an effort to muddy the waters, because this issue, which has been such a big, big winner for him for so long, is a loser when you look at the national electorate in 1996.
What would it mean?
I think that's right. I'm sorry, Amy. I just wanted to add that Senator Dole has really made a career of targeting physicians, beginning with Dr. Roy and not ending with Henry Foster. He demonized Henry Foster, that's true, but he has supported legislation that would jail doctors who perform certain abortion procedures late in pregnancy that are necessary for their health or their lives or because of fetal abnormalities. He recently, just last week, voted to make it more difficult for OBGYN residents to be trained in abortion procedures. He has made a career of targeting doctors, and when you he's voted against the clinic protection law that would have provided more safety, more resources to the federal government, so that increasing safety for doctors who are now being murdered.
And yet, Kate Michaelman, wouldn't you say that in that case, Pat Buchanan has served him well because it makes him look like a moderate on abortion?
Well, you know, it's an interesting point that you raise, Amy. Indeed, in comparison, people say, oh, but Pat Buchanan is so wildly extreme. The interesting thing is that Bob Dole and Pat Buchanan, as presidents, would do exactly the same thing. Bob Dole would carry out the very same anti-abortion, anti-reproductive choice program as Pat Buchanan. It's just that he is not a demagogue, Bob Dole. And so you're right, Amy, that in comparison, he looks more moderate. But in fact, voters need to understand, and that's what NARAL intends to make happen, they need to know and understand that Bob Dole's record is very clear, and that he is anti-choice, that he would do exactly what Pat Buchanan would do when in the White House.
Kate Michaelman, we have 20 seconds. Are you conducting any voter registration campaigns around the country?
We are not conducting voter registration. We are conducting voter education programs all over the country. And, of course, we'll be doing, through our PAC, electoral work in targeting districts as well as working to protect the president.
Well, Kate Michaelman, head of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, and Dr. William Roy, a senatorial opponent of Bob Dole's in 1974, former congressmember before that, and then practicing OBGYN. We want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
And you're listening to Democracy Now! As we wrap up. But Not Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, with assistance from Pat Greenfield. It was engineered by Bernard White in New York and Joe Gale in Washington. Errol Maitland is our director. Production assistance from Zachary Fink. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can send us some email. Our address, democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Tomorrow, our guest, consumer activist and presidential candidate Ralph Nader. I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica's daily national grassroots election show, Democracy Now! Thanks for listening.